Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Craig Emerson makes a welcome return to the Sydney Institute. He's been here on a number of occasions before, and I see that in his Who entry he missed one of his speeches here among the significant articles he's written. So it's great to have him back. He's well known to all of you, so I'll introduce him very briefly. He's had time as an academic, as a public servant, a political advisor. He's also an author, published author, studied economics at Sydney and did his PhD at the ANU. And Dr. Emerson's been the MP for Rankin since 1998. He's served a number of senior positions in opposition and in government since 2007, but of course at the moment as the Federal Minister for Trade in the Cabinet. And Dr. Emerson's going to talk to us tonight on the Asian century. Dr. Craig Emerson, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Thanks, Jared, and thanks for the opportunity. I think it was about 1999 when I first appeared here with Julie Bishop as an up-and-coming backbencher. So we both got up and got coming, and here we are. So Julie has been a cabinet minister and no doubt would like to be one again, and I'll see what I can do to prevent that happening. But we do get on very well. We do get on very well, and that's how it should be in our democracy. I did want to talk to you tonight about Australia in the Asian century. You all have heard something of that already, but if I can add a little bit more substance to what you've heard to this point, then that will have been a worthwhile contribution. We're looking to release a white paper on Australia in the Asian century within probably a month or so, and it has been a very big endeavour, and I want to give you some insights into our thinking, motivation behind that, and where we think we can head on the basis of that work that has been done. And it's true that for most people around the world, when we think of the first decade and now a couple of years on of the 21st century, there have been two big economic events. And the first is the deepest global recession since the Great Depression that began with the global financial crisis. And we did weather that very well as a nation. All hands were on deck, and I won't go through the relative contributions to weathering that, but it was a joint effort, a real partnership. And I think we're able to say proudly that Australia is in its 22nd year of continuous economic growth, having weathered that global financial crisis and that deep recession. But the second event defining the early part of the 21st century is Asia's re-emergence. And I do deliberately refer to Asia's re-emergence because history tells us that until the 19th century, Asia made up around half of the global economy. I don't know whether they had an Australian Bureau of Statistics or an Asian Bureau of Statistics around that time or a global Bureau of Statistics, but very good economic historians estimate that Asia contributed around half of the global economy up until around the 19th century. So it was only during a short period in the broad history of human development from the mid-18th century to the mid-20th century that economic power shifted from Asia to the West, driven by European and North American industrialisation. But then after the Second World War, the West's relative advantage began eroding, as first we saw Japan in its post-war reconstruction and industrialization, then Taiwan, and a little later Korea, developing large industrial bases. And of course, we know that Singapore was developing rapidly as well. Over the last few decades, this shift in the global center of economic activity back to Asia has accelerated as the Asian giants of China, India, and Indonesia have begun to transform their economies through opening up those economies to the world. And most dramatic, of course, has been China's transformation, and that seems to make most of the headlines based on its industrialization, but its urbanization. And even now, despite that urbanization, a majority of the Chinese citizenry still live on the land, but it has truly been a transformative event. When a country like China, with a population a third bigger again than North America and the EU combined, starts industrializing, it's no surprise that it fundamentally changes economic relationships and that global center of economic activity. And a great humanitarian endeavor it has been, because in Asia, the rise of China, the rise or re-emergence of China, India and Indonesia has literally liberated hundreds of millions of people from poverty. In my lifetime alone, Asia's share of the global economy has doubled, and that's why we have been working on this white paper to determine how to make the most of the opportunities on offer in the Asian century. And of course, we'll talk about Asia's rise, how that happened and how it has affected Australia in the past. But primarily, it's obviously a forward-looking document, and it will set out national objectives for Australia. It'll consider how to support our businesses to better continue the process of Australia's economic integration with Asia. And I won't, for the sake of time, go through the post-war events that have led to that re-engagement, but I will pick on one. Okay, I'm biased. I used to work for Bob Hawke, and I think he was a great Prime Minister, but that engagement of Bob Hawke with Chinese leadership was a very defining moment in our economic history, but we celebrate as well. This year, in December, 40 years of Australian diplomatic recognition of the People's Republic of China. I could talk about Harold Holt beginning the processes to dismantle the White Australia policy. I could talk about John McEwen and Bob Menzies creating and writing and negotiating a commerce agreement with Japan in 1957. And I could talk about many other leaders. But there were these efforts that led to the engagement of Australia with Asia and a concerted effort, I think, around the Hawke-Keating era to achieve economic integration, or as Bob used to describe it, enmeshment between Australia and Asia. Not the most elegant word, but it was a Bob word and it stood the test of time, so we're enmeshing. One of the phenomena associated with the development or re-emergence of Asia is that East Asia leads the world in a relatively new phenomenon called global value chains. And this is where different countries with their particular skills and cost advantages each contribute something towards a final product that is sold in a final marketplace. That something could be componentry for manufacturing, it could be services associated with the production, distribution and sale of a final product. It could be legal services, could be design services. And the truth is that the intra-Asian trade is growing far more rapidly than Asia's trade with the rest of the world through these value chains. And we think that for our manufacturers and our service industries, we need to develop a mindset that looks at these opportunities of these regional and global value chains and find out where we can link into those. And that's one of the messages that I want to mention tonight, or bring to you tonight, and observe that our participation as a country in these value chains is very low by international standards. So we think that that needs to change, because these value chains will expand and proliferate across all parts of the global economy. That means too that from the government perspective, we need to ensure that our export assistance programs are better geared towards these emerging value chains. We want to support our small and medium-sized enterprises in particular to grow and to integrate into those value chains with an emphasis on Asia's emerging and frontier markets. I think it's fair to say that our efforts through Austrade, through the Export Market Development Grant Scheme, through the Export Finance and Insurance Corporation have been spread widely around the world, and there may be an argument to start thinking about focusing those more on the frontier and emerging markets where our costs, if you like, of searching and getting familiar with these markets are very high compared with the more mature markets. That's exactly what we've done with Austrade, and it is now setting up offices in emerging markets such as Kazakhstan, Mongolia, and in Latin America, in Colombia. Just by way of example, that has meant we've actually had to close some offices, but it is a refocusing of our effort, and we are looking at the possibility of doing that in relation to the Export Finance and Investment Corporation as well, because these markets are difficult to break into, but, you know, of course, the opportunities, the potential rewards are great. I met with the president of Ford today, Robert Graziano, and he told me about the Ford Ranger. It's a vehicle that is essentially designed here in Australia but produced across three countries in Ford's global production chain. And it's an example of Australia succeeding in what we do best, and that is adding value to production that involves large doses of research and development and skills, because that's our strength, rather than low wage costs or massive scale of production, which is the strength of other countries in the region. So this is the sort of thinking that we're doing, and I think we're doing it in an environment where countries outside of the region, the developed countries, are still grappling with the problems that they are confronting in terms of getting out from beneath the mountains of debt. So they have to concentrate their efforts there, and because we're fierce competitors, this is an opportunity to concentrate our efforts on the future with its engagement and enmeshment with Asia. You know, there's been a lot said about the whether the resources boom is partly over, half over, fully over, three quarters over. I just wanted to just take you through some of the facts there. Obviously, our mineral prices have gone up over the last decade or so. The prices for metallurgical coal have increased sixfold in a handful of years, and the prices of iron ore pushed our terms of trade to 140-year highs. And on the back of that, investment is pouring into the country. That has helped shield us from the worst effects of that global recession. But our exports to Asia nearly doubled from 120 billion to 220 billion just between 2001 and 2011. Now, what people are observing is that the export prices have come down, and this is being equated with a collapse in export prices. But in fact, they've come down from from stellar peaks to a shoulder, not to, you know, some sort of abyss. And that's why we don't share the pessimism that is displayed in the media regularly, that, you know, the resources boom is over, export prices have collapsed. In fact, the International Monetary Fund itself has confirmed that in the next couple of years we will reach peaks of investment as a share of GDP. So that means that the price boom, sure, might be coming off. The investment boom, we're not even halfway through, and there's probably, even in the pipeline, up to a decade more of investment associated with the mining boom. And why do we invest? To produce mine output. And so, in the words of the Carpenters, and I won't sing, but the song is "We've Only Just Begun," Jared. And you will remember that. You must remember this: a kiss is but a kiss. Anyway, I'm just saying. I'm just this is for dinner afterwards when there aren't any cameras. But we have only just begun with the minerals production boom. So that's the good news, but we're not a one-trick country. And what we've been doing through this whole period, rather than saying, oh, well, let's just expect the mining boom to last forever, is to look at ways of diversifying our economy. I've covered one through the integration into these regional value chains, which is valuable for our manufacturing and our service industries. But when I took a group of more than 100 businesses last August through China, we didn't go to Beijing. We went to the Western cities, including Chengdu, Changsha, Chongqing, and Wuhan. And these are enormous cities of 8, 10, 20, 30 million people. You know, when they say out and west of China and you turn up to a place like Chongqing and there's 30 million people there, it's absolutely breathtaking. And so we took our service industry people there, our designers, our architects, people who are good at energy efficiency, even media content creators. And there was a lot of engagement, and we think that by working with those provincial areas, we can ensure that our service industries that already contribute 80% of our employment enjoy that economic integration as well. But I wanted to touch on another part of our economy which some people have regarded as having very little by the way of future prospects, and that again is a pessimism not shared by this government, and that is agriculture. Between now and 2050, the world's population will grow from 7 billion to 9.3 billion people. That's a big addition to the world's population. In addition, through these developments that we're describing here tonight, as Asia's middle classes will expand by 2035 to 3 billion people. 3 billion middle class customers in what is going to be fabulously wealthy parts of our region, demanding the sorts of services that we're talking about, education services, tourism services, but very much high-protein food sources, beef, sheep meat, obviously pork, chicken, poultry, other forms of poultry and fish. Well, here it is for us. Look at Northern Australia. Look at the capacity, the untapped potential of Northern Australia to produce more beef in particular. And you see a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity for our country. Now, this is an opportunity. It is not a threat. And there has been a political discourse that the Chinese are coming, they're going to buy our farmland, they're going to bring Chinese labour, they're going to take over the place and dedicate the production to their home market. That is not true. In fact, I've worked with my colleague and friend Chen Deming, who's the Commerce Minister of China, at a dinner conversation about a year ago. I suggested we set up a joint study to look at the possibilities of Northern Australia in supplying more beef for the world market. What China wants is that there is greater availability of food on the world market. They're happy to buy it. But China, like Indonesia, like India, and other countries of the world are very anxious about the prospect of food shortages. Food shortages lead to malnutrition, they lead to starvation in some countries, and they lead to civil unrest. And you only need to look at 2008 to see what happened with food riots around the world. This is an issue of a great humanitarian endeavour, and at the same time, it is an issue, in my view, of peace and stability in the world. Because we can't, in planning for the future, just turn our backs and say that Australia will produce for itself, notwithstanding that 60% of our produce already goes on the domestic market, onto the international market, and not play a part in this great humanitarian endeavour. So my argument, it is not a threat, it's an opportunity. I come from the country. We left the country in 1970. We had to because things were going bad. There was a drought. Timber quotas were being applied because the timber had been overcut. That country town that I lived in has shrunk from 900 people to less than 500 people. If it continues to shrink, there goes the bank, there goes the post office, there goes the doctor, there goes the hospital, there goes the people. And here we have a once-in-a-generation opportunity to revitalise and to achieve genuine market-driven regional development in this country. And so what the government says, what Julia Gillard says, what I'm saying, is this is not a threat to Australia. This is an opportunity to achieve the sorts of regional development that even Gough Whitlam, way back 40 years ago, was talking about with Bathurst Orange Growth Centres, Albury Wodonga Growth Centres. But this time, instead of being delivered by government, it's delivered by the market. So let's join in this great humanitarian endeavour to ensure that when Asia's re-emergence continues, when those 3 billion people become middle-class customers in our region demanding high-protein foods, that we play our role in this great humanitarian endeavour, in this great effort to achieve regional development in this country. And let's put aside and dismiss out of hand the xenophobic rantings that we've seen, which are all about seeking to harvest votes, not to harvest wheat, not to harvest crops. People obviously are a bit apprehensive about this. People in the bush hear stuff and then it just rolls through the bush. I know that. I come from these sorts of towns. But that's inevitable. What we need to do is make sure that we get as much information in front of the public as we possibly can on these matters to make sure that we do, if we can, have a land register, tell people that the truth is, rather than exponential increase in foreign ownership of agricultural land, in 1984, 5.9% of our agricultural land was owned by foreigners. The exponential increase between 1984 and 2010, 0.1 percentage points, as it went from 5.9% to 6%. And most people don't know that. They hear that the foreigners are here and buying up all our land. So we'll continue the work on this joint study, Jared, and our plan is to release it in conjunction with the Asian Century White Paper. But I'd urge everyone here, if you're interested, to participate in what is going to be a great national debate and a great national opportunity. So I just wanted to finish by saying that all of this works if we've got a free trade area for Asia and the Pacific. And that's what we're seeking. There are two potential mechanisms to deliver this idea of free trade area for Asia and the Pacific. One is the Trans-Pacific Partnership that comprises, at the moment, 11 APEC member economies. If Japan joins, that'll be 12. There's another concept which may emerge, which is a regional comprehensive economic partnership involving some of those overlapping countries, but ASEAN and its six free trade agreement partners in the region, which does include Australia. Both of those, or either of those, could be a pathway to a free trade area for Asia and the Pacific. And I'll leave with this observation. When I did step in for Prime Minister Julia Gillard when her dad died in the most unfortunate of circumstances in Vladivostok, the leaders had various items on the agenda to discuss. And we got onto the issue of food security. And you know the diversity of economic systems within APEC. And to a leader, they were saying what we need to do is allow markets to work, not step in, not apply export controls, but to ensure that through specialisation and through market forces, the world itself will find the most productive places to meet that great food challenge. So I thought that was a really encouraging development out of APEC. It's exactly right up the alley that Australia wants to travel. I think the 21st century obviously is the Asian century. We want to be in the right place at the right time in the Asian region, in the Asian century, and that's what the White Paper is intended to do, to develop pathways so that we can take advantage of the splendid opportunities available, the great diversity of career opportunities for our young people as we do take advantage of the Asian century. Thanks very much.
Okay, there are many thanks, Craig Emerson. So now we come to questions and discussion. Just hang on a second. I'm just looking for Anne, but I can't find her. Oh, I want to talk to you about something in a second.
Some of the old songs.
The joke earlier on was I accused the minister of upsetting me deeply in recent times because I can't get wipe out out of my mind. It keeps I wake up at 2 o'clock in the morning.
What's the other song? You were always on my mind.
No.
So this could deteriorate. Yes. So I just want to thank King and Wood Mellisons for the use of this very fine facility tonight. Just to recap on one point, and then to ask you a brief question. The white paper, just give us the timetable. When's it due? I mean, I imagine it goes to Cabinet, so when are you expecting that to come out? And how would it be any different the day after it's released than the day? But, I mean, how would it be different from what you're saying tonight to what might be said after the white paper comes out? And then secondly, as I recall, Labour and opposition, you're very, very led in this debate for a long time, from your time working at Bob Hawke and on. But as I recall, Labour and opposition pretty well focused on multilateral trade deals. But I think in government you're still doing that, but you are focusing a bit on bilateral deals. And I just wonder what's happened to the China-Australia deal, which you would have discussed that out when you're in China.
Thanks, Jared. And obviously they're actually very good questions, and I didn't weave them in because then I would have spoken for too long. The ambition is to have the white paper out by the end of October. I won't give a specific date at this stage, but that's what we're aiming for. How will things be different as between this speech and the white paper, the day before and the day after the release of the white paper? It's been an exercise of great value in terms of talking to the community at large, academics, business people, farmers. There's been enormous a collaborative effort in going into that. I would say that it is, if you like, a set of pathways that we would think, based on all that consultation, are productive to travel in taking advantage of the opportunities on offer in the Asian century. Don't expect, and I know you wouldn't, but don't expect that it's going to involve the unveiling of hundreds of millions of dollars to be thrown at particular issues. This is a long-term exercise. Of course, flowing out of that will be a series of policy developments over the coming years. And, you know, I'm absolutely committed to us having an overall story to tell, that everything that we do then fits into it. And I'll give you one classic example of that. In our region, now in Asia, are four of the top five performing school systems. Now, that wasn't the case 10 years ago. Our education performance, as measured by PISA, so their international tests, has fallen in the last 10 years. If we are to take advantage, literally, of how I finished that speech, of the splendid diversity of opportunities available for our young people, they need to be competitive. And so the whole exercise that we're undertaking of reform of the school system, a move to a needs-based funding model, more autonomy for teachers, all of that properly fits into the Asian century. So we're not just going to come up with tricks and say, here's the Asian century white paper, and we've got a few tricks, then move on. It is actually an integrated strategy. And the last thing I'll say about it, so we've got time for more questions, it's not all economics. It's very much cultural, it's people-to-people relationships, because it will be your experience, and it is certainly my experience, that when you talk to the leadership of Asia at the moment, they'll tell you that they're studying in Australia or their kids are studying in Australia. This is a fantastic investment. A fantastic investment, not just in economics, but, you know, in friendship, peace and stability in our region, and they're the sorts of themes, that's the sort of emphasis that we'll be giving it, rather than, you know, keeping up with the 24-hour media cycle and say, here it is, it's announced, let's move on to something else. Finally, on the trade front, you're right, we have a very strong commitment to the multilateral system. On Monday night, I'll be going to Geneva. I'll be doing it in a most unspectacular way. I'm simply going to talk to the negotiators, not the ministers, but the people who've spent the last 11 years in Geneva slogging it out and frankly achieving nothing, and trying to instill in them a sense of purpose, a sense of confidence that we can make progress. And one of the areas is trade facilitation. I'll talk to you about it later, but just making it easier for countries to trade with each other through streamlined customs procedures and so on. I'm going with Jock Lowry. We're going to try to rev the joint up on agriculture. But while that's going on, and it has been going on for 11 years, the Doha round, we need to do what we can regionally. And there comes in the Trans-Pacific Partnership. There comes in the possibility of a regional comprehensive economic partnership. And there comes in the bilateral deals. Jared, the truth is, when I became Trade Minister, I said the Australian government is only interested in high-quality, ambitious, truly liberalising agreements. Unless and until we can get a high-quality, truly liberalising agreement, we won't settle. That's our commitment, because we're not going to just assemble a whole bunch of computer mugs to sit up on the national mantelpiece so I can say, what a good fellow am I. So we're going to keep pushing until we get really high-quality outcomes. If you were to ask me when's that going to be, it's not completely in our control. But that's the standard that we've set for ourselves. That's the standard that we will achieve.
Thank you. So there's a question here, and then we'll go down the back.
Yes. Minister, you've said that there is a need to develop the small businesses in the intellect trade with China.
Yeah.
However, many small businesses pay personal income tax, and the top personal income tax rate hasn't been cut for many years. And with the carbon tax, they do not have the investment capital for plant, equipment, and research to compete. My question is that, isn't the government sending a message to them that they should struggle to succeed, export more, hire more people for the benefit of the country, but they will not be rewarded or thanked for it? In fact, they will be punished.
I think you might have forgotten about the use of some of the revenue from the minerals resource rent tax and the carbon pricing mechanism, which is to provide immediate write-off for assets valued up at $6,000 to $6,500 each for small businesses. The purpose of that is to give them incentive to invest in new productive assets, to do at a small business scale what we think can and probably should be done for Australia as a whole, and that is retool Australia. This is the second great economic transformation after the creation of the open competitive economy. And of course, you know, wouldn't it be great if no one had to pay the top marginal tax rate or any tax at all? We do have a progressive tax system, but what we're doing is providing genuine incentive for small businesses through some of the proceeds of the mineral resource rent tax, and they certainly won't be paying that, in order to give them the incentive to invest in new productive assets. In terms of our own government authorities, there will be, and there is, an increased emphasis, as I said to you, by Austrade on our region and to supporting small and medium enterprises in integrating into those value chains, whether by services or the production of any particular manufactured goods. And we are looking at the Export Finance and Insurance Corporation to see whether that might be the right direction for it to go to, so that we've deployed, if you like, aimed all of our resources in the same direction rather than spread them, if you like, arbitrarily or fairly equally around the world.
Especially down the back, then we come over here, then we go there. Yeah.
You speak eloquently of your relationship with Peter Bishop. You also distance yourself from the Whitlam era and its top-down or bureaucratically driven economic model. Do you think possibly you really belong in the Liberal Party? Or has the Labor Party simply moved more to the centre and has distanced itself from its previous socialist chifflish?
I think the Liberal Party is far too interventionist for me, so I'll stick with the Labor Party, thanks. If you look at wheat market deregulation right now, what's happening right now, we have a bill that we want to introduce into the Parliament to complete the deregulation of the wheat marketing system in this country after the Howard government actually got rid of the single desk. That now looks like it's going to be opposed. And that's wrong, because if we're going to do what we can do in the Asian century for our agriculture, we must be as efficient as possible. And of all the people who would want that deregulation to occur, it's the producers of the highest quality wheat, the hard wheat, in Western Australia. Now, I'm just saying, Julie's had to the weight of the National Party on her on that, as she has had on the foreign investment debate that's gone on earlier. But she fought back on that, and it's inelegant, but at least it's not as bad as it was before when Barnaby Joyce was really ranting around the country and, in my view, doing our country no good whatsoever. Maybe his standing in the potential pre-selection battle might have been enhanced, but that's gone too because Bruce Scott is renominating. So to end, to finish the question, I actually admired Gough Whitlam's vision, but at that time there probably weren't the market mechanisms, even culturally in Australia. It was at a time when we really were still debating whether we should have high tariff walls or not. That competition back then was maybe very suspicious, if not bad. So I don't think we can now deliver a verdict on de Gough using the vantage point of the second decade of the 21st century. I thought he had great vision. I thought he was a great reformer. But we now have the tools available to us to deliver some of that vision, including the decentralisation of Australia through market mechanisms.
Minister, thank you for an excellent presentation. I was particularly interested in your comments on value chains and Australia's participation in value chains. Of course, in Asia, most of the countries participating in value chains are geographically close to each other. And Australia, or most of Australia's population, is geographically a long, long way from the Asian centres. Do you see that as a constraint for us, the big distances?
Could we
see a shift in Australia's population towards the north?
A friend of mine once said on that latter point, why are we taking the water to the farmers? How about we take the farmers to the water? And that's the sort of idea that Bill Heffernan and others would have supported. Easier said than done, but there is something in doing the best we can to capture and conserve water in the north, because that's the constraint, isn't it? It's not that there's no water, it's capturing it and conserving it. And some analyses, such as the CSIRO, suggest that the soil isn't capable of doing that, that the water catchment would be very shallow and there would be enormous evaporation. There are alternative views, and I think that is a perfectly healthy debate. So I was answering the second part first about moving the farmers north. Asia itself is a pretty big place. I fly around there a lot, and sure, some parts are close to each other, other parts are further away. But what I definitely can say is Asia is a lot closer than Europe. And, you know, to integrate ourselves into Europe would not be a very smart idea. And I think that let's not underestimate a couple of the attributes that we have that are valued in Asia. We're in the same time zone. Now, I don't know how to put a kind of quantitative analysis of that, but I do know that people from Asia like it. Their kids study here. They come down here. We actually have senior ministers coming unofficially and holidaying in Australia. So it has people thinking about Australia. Now, that is probably as important as the spreadsheets doing benefit cost analyses. To have a reputational advantage where they say Australia is an honest, open country with a transparent and legal system, all of these are attributes that can help overcome what I think you're raising as a legitimate constraint. We're not as close to each of those countries as they are to each other. But we have a really good reputation. And if we can build on that through the white paper and deploy some of our own government resources to, in a sense, help those small and medium-sized enterprises understand the markets, understand provincial governments, particularly the emerging markets, then I think the future is ours.
So we go here and then we go down there. Yep.
Minister, I can only agree with your suggestion that we should have high-quality FTAs, but Australia is now in a very disadvantaged position on the Korean FTA, because the Americans have signed that FTA.
That's right.
We have been promised that FTA by the Australian Prime Minister and the Korean presidents by Christmas, I think, for each of the last three Christmases. How are we going to go for this Christmas?
I think literally if you look at their statements, they would say do everything possible or our best efforts.
Create the impression of...
Well, it is different from saying it will be done by a particular time, and I'm not being... literal about this, because I learned early on that with these trade deals, as soon as you set a deadline, you've ensured that you'll miss it. But your point is fair, and that is we have now effectively defensive interests because of the US trade deal with Korea. It's a lucrative market for our agricultural producers, particularly our beef producers. We're in a situation now where it's still at an impasse. There have been reasons for impasses before. There's another reason for an impasse now. There's a presidential election in November. We would love to see progress before that, but I think the truth is that the public service system, the bureaucracy's kind of gone into almost caretaker mode. And so there's not a day go by when I don't think of how we can get around and get that Korean deal done. So we're not just sitting back waiting for something to happen, but at the same time, we have demands on us that we can't accommodate at this stage. So let's see what happens in November. Let's see at least then the public service, if the civil service won't be in lockdown or in caretaker, and we might be able to move it on.
There's a question here.
Yeah. Minister, I was very interested in your comments about the contribution of the services to the global supply chain.
Yeah.
If we cast forward, say, 10 years, would you see that Australian services contributing into Asia would be on a generalist model or on a sort of centres of excellence model where there are some things that we do really well?
Yeah.
And if it's the latter, how do we get there?
I think it literally is a combination of the two. When we talk about services, we are, of their very nature, talking about an enormous range of services. So we could be talking about education, and that is very different from, say, tourism services, and that's very different from architectural design services or funds management. So they've all got their opportunities, but because we might be good at attracting tourists, that doesn't mean we're good necessarily at funds management or successful at funds management. I think we are good at funds management. So we'd have to really develop our own strategies for each of the different types of services. And as I alluded to earlier, it may not be fully or overwhelmingly with a national government. It could be with provincial governments in China. It could be with state governments in India, you know, with chief ministers. So I think we need to be very pragmatic about how we seek to work with industry sectors in developing strategies. I am not of the mode of, you know, 30 or 40 years ago of just developing a strategy by sitting people around the table, producing a really nice document, put a cover on it and say that's done. This is the sort of day-to-day engagement of Austrade officials. Trade missions are actually quite valuable because in our region, if they see a minister, it's kind of a certificate of authenticity for those particular service providers. And I'll finish with an example. Just near here is the oldest architectural firm in Australia. They came to Western China with me, and they're already familiar with Western China. I think they designed the water cube for the Beijing Olympics. But, you know, there are abilities or attributes that we've picked up where if you're looking at the laws of comparative advantage, you might not say Australia's a world leader in architectural design, but maybe we are in China, and maybe that's because of the relationships that are being developed.
Question there. Yes.
Minister, I think it's a reasonable observation that the government has struggled with agenda setting for a number of years. This particular idea is not necessarily a new idea. It's the Jeff Kennett supermarket to Asia sort of stuff from over 10 years ago. And so I just wonder what you think is going to be different about the government's ability to tell this story and to engage business and the public in the agenda.
It's comprehensiveness. To be honest, I wasn't aware of Jeff Kennett's supermarket to Asia. And that's not, you know, being clever or anything. I think that these sorts of things can come and go. You know, the food bowl for Asia has been around for a long time as well. And then it's in fashion, then it's out of fashion, then back in fashion. But as I said earlier, this isn't just about an economic strategy. It's very much about improving our Asia capabilities, our Asia literacy in our schools. It's a, you know, to use a basketball analogy, a full court press, rather than say, well, there's some things that we could do better in Asia. That's going to happen anyway. You know, we'll always be looking for opportunities in Asia, whether it be minerals and energy or some of these other areas that we're talking about. But I think if there's a national discussion, and a national story to be told, and people are trying to understand why we're doing different things, including, for example, deregulating our own economy, removing the barriers between states that affect business and affect business productivity. And if you say, explain that that is to give our businesses the best chance possible to be competitive in the Asian region in the Asian century, it all makes a bit more sense, I think. And these policies and strategies can reinforce each other. So I think it's the comprehensiveness and the fact that the different forces that we can deploy at the government level, federal, state, and also business level, academic level, getting them all pushing in the same or directed in the same direction, which is north into Asia, itself can have really compounding benefits.
Do you think you'll be able to overcome the populist sort of public sentiment of Barnaby Joyce's and the Joneses? And
I think it's tough, actually. I think it's tough. Because it's just so easy. You know, the story that they tell is so easy. And that's why I get so upset about it. Our story is a harder story to tell. But I do believe that instinctively the Australian people know this, that we're not going back to Mother England. We're not going to make good jobs and create great careers for our kids by linking into Europe. Of course, there'll be some, and that's a good thing. Same thing with North America. You know, it's a competitive world. It's a fair way away, North America. Our trade with North America is actually growing, but nothing like the opportunities in our own region, where countries, instead of growing at 1.5% to 2% per annum, are growing at 7% to 10% per annum, including the second and third biggest countries on Earth, China and India, economies on Earth, and countries with population. I think the people know that. They're a bit scared about it all, but they also think it would be really stupid to turn our backs on it. And so that's where we come in, to say, you're right, it would be really stupid to turn our backs on it. So don't listen to Joyce, don't listen to Alan Jones. You know, make sure that we've got a real career for your kids. And I think, Jared, to go back to answer, you know, really your question, if people can see that their kids can be architects, their kids can be in the financial markets, their kids can be working in high-quality tourist facilities here in the most beautiful city on earth because of what we're doing in Asia, then I think they'll be pretty happy about that. But the debate's on. Barnaby's got every right to state his claim, and I've got every right to deal with it and to refute it, and I will.
I was listening for a bit, but when you spoke mainly about China, although we're talking about Asia, and India's huge,
yep,
as huge as China, Indonesia's vast, hugely populated, and we didn't do very well in the live beef exports there. What are the other opportunities and what are the pitfalls for Asia,
yeah,
not just China, which we
seem to be. And I did mention China, that's true. The Asian Century White Paper doesn't seek to focus by any means exclusively on China. In fact, it will make the point very clearly that China is not Asia. China doesn't believe it's Asia, neither do we. It's a big powerhouse economy, 1.32 billion people. India's population will overtake it. India is the third biggest economy in the world. Japan is still a very big economy, by the way. And Indonesia has 245 million people, and we think it will be a top 10 economy by 2025, top 10 in the world. So we would have, by 2025, the first or second, depending on how you measure it, in China, the third and the 10th, and then we'd have other G20 countries such as our own, Korea, and so on. So you're right. I mean, and what's defining this is the rates of growth. You know, as I say, in the first decade of this century, China grew on average at 10% per annum, a country with 1.3 billion people. Real terms, 10% per annum. India, 7% per annum. Indonesia, 5% per annum. So it's just astonishing what's going on in our region. And we will work with each of those countries. We actually have a very good relationship, by the way, with Indonesia. So I wouldn't dwell on the live cattle suspension. I mean, it was, you know, a challenging period, that's true. But it's not as if everyone gets up in the morning in Indonesia and says, gee, what about that large cattle suspension? They're actually working with us on capacity building in their own herd because they want to increase consumption of beef from 2 kilograms per person per year to perhaps 20. That's a tenfold increase in demand for beef, and they see us as a major supplier, plus their own ambitions for their own herds and a way of liberating more people from poverty. But you're right, I won't spend any more time on it, but India, the Prime Minister's going there next month, I think it is, and we're putting a big effort there as well. So it'll be about ASEAN, it'll be about Korea, it'll be about Japan, India, China, Indonesia, the whole lot. And a newly emerging country called Myanmar.
Yes. Just a final question. It was sad the Prime Minister had to leave Vladivostok early, but you had to step in. So that would be unusual for a cabinet minister to be representing his country. So did the other leaders there treat you like they would have treated the Prime Minister?
Yeah.
And as you know, President Obama couldn't get there, but Mr. Putin was there.
Yeah.
So what was that experience like?
Oh, it was fascinating, and I wasn't worried, to be candid with you, about my capacity to, you know, represent Australia at the meetings. I was just worried that if I went to walk into a room, that security would stop me and say, who are you? I was more concerned about the logistics, but once I was in the room, I was fine. And, you know, I told the Australian story. I talked about the sorts of things that we're talking about tonight, and a number of those leaders were very complimentary on the food security issue, for example, and said, that's really fascinating, you know, some of the points that I made just now. So I really enjoyed it, but in the saddest of circumstances,
yes.
Really.
You clearly did a good job. So many thanks. Just take a seat over here. Well, I'll be brief. It's great to have Dr. Emerson back at the Sydney Institute. There are not many people that this description fits. I think it's true to say that Craig Emerson made an important contribution to the political debate before he went into national politics, and this has continued as he has been in national politics, and a lot of politicians make an impact when they get into politics, but not many make an impact before they get into politics, and he's been able to do both, which is quite an achievement. As we can see from tonight, Dr. Emerson is well informed across a range of issues. I'll be very brief. I'm very pleased he's come along here tonight to talk on such an important topic. I wish him well for the future. I think it's fair to say that Craig Emerson has been one of the best performers in the Rudd and Gillard government, and no doubt he'll be back again in the future. But for tonight, well done and thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.